Disc 9.
Investigating a double murder with only yourself and a sergeant is hardly ideal. I can't see why you can't call in technical backing from the local force. If the Sockos and fingerprint people keep away from anyone who is infected, there shouldn't be a serious risk. It will be for the Home Office to authorise, of course. Kate said, Sergeant Benton Smith and I don't yet know whether we are infected, sir. There is that, I suppose. Anyway, the control of infection isn't our concern. The double murders are. I'll have a word with the CC at Exeter. At least they can cope with any exhibits. You'd better carry on with Benton Smith, at least for the next 3 days. That will bring us to Friday. After that, we'll see how things develop. Keep me informed, of course. How is Mr. Dalgliesh, by the way? Kate said, I don't know, sir. I haven't liked to worry Dr. Staveley with inquiries. I'm hoping I'll be able to speak to him and get some news later today. Harkness said, I'll ring Staveley myself and talk to Mr. Dalgliesh if he's well enough. Kate thought, you'll be lucky. She had a feeling that Guy Staveley would be highly effective in protecting his patient. After ringing off, she steeled herself to make the second, more difficult call. She tried to rehearse what she would say to Emma Lavenham, but nothing seemed right. The words were either too frightening or too reassuring. There were two numbers on the paper AD had left, Emma's mobile and a landline. Staring at them didn't make the choice any easier. In the end, she decided to try the landline first. It was early. Emma might still be in her room at college. Perhaps AD had already spoken to her, but she thought that was unlikely. With no mobile, he would have to use the phone in the surgery, and Dr. Staveley would hardly see that as a priority. After only 5 rings, Emma Lavenham's clear voice, confident and unconcerned, came on the line, bringing with it a confusion of memories and emotions. As soon as Kate announced herself, the voice changed. It's Adam, isn't it? I'm afraid it is. He's asked me to let you know that he's not well. He'll ring as soon as he can. He sends you his love. Emma was keeping herself under control, but her voice was edged with fear. How not well? Has he had an accident? Is it serious? Kate, please tell me. Not an accident. You'll hear about it on the next radio news, I imagine. One of the visitors here arrived with SARS. Mr. Dalgliesh caught it. He's in the sick room. The silence seemed interminable, and so absolute that Kate wondered whether the line was dead. Then Emma's voice. How bad is he? Please, Kate, I have to be told. Kate said, It's only just happened. I don't really know very much myself. I hope to find out how he is when I go to the house later today, but I'm sure he'll be all right. He's in good hands. I mean, SARS isn't like that Asian bird flu. She was speaking from ignorance, trying to reassure, but careful not to lie. But how could she tell the truth when she didn't know it? She added, And he's very strong. Emma said, with a heartbreaking lack of self-pity, He was tired when he took the case. I can't come to him, I know that. I can't even try to speak to him. I don't suppose they'd let me, and he mustn't be worried about me and what I'm feeling. That's not important now. But I expect you'll be able to get a message to him. Tell him I'm thinking of him. Give him my love. And, Kate, you will ring me, won't you? You will tell me the truth, however bad. Nothing can be worse than what I'll be imagining. Yes, Emma, I'll ring you. And I'll always tell you as much as I know. Goodbye. Replacing the receiver, she thought, not tell him that I love him, just give him my love. That's the kind of message any friend would send. But what other words were there, unless they could be spoken face to face? She thought, we both want to say the same words. I've always known why I can't say them. But he loves her. So why can't she? She went back to the chapel and began to search, stepping carefully around the body, scrutinizing the stone floor, moving slowly, eyes down, Then she went outside into the fresh morning air. Was it her imagination that it smelled sweeter? Surely it was too soon for even the first tentative but unmistakable stench of death. She tried to take in the implications of solving two murders with no resources but Benton and herself. For both of them, the stakes were high, but whatever the outcome, the final responsibility would be hers. And the outside world, their world, would find no excuses for failure. Both murders were copybook killings. A small, closed society. No access from outside. A limited number of suspects. Even more limited now that Speidel had an alibi for Boyd's death. Only if she and Benton both fell victim to SARS would failure be excused. Both were at risk of infection. Both had sat closeted with Dalgleish for an hour in his sitting room at Seal Cottage. Now they would be investigating murder under the threat of a dreaded disease. But she knew that the risk of catching SARS was far less onerous to her, as it would be to Benton, than the fear of public failure, of leaving Coombe Island with the case unsolved. And now she saw him in the distance, cycling vigorously, the camera strapped round his neck, one hand on the middle of the handlebars, the other holding her murder case. He flung the bike against the wall of Seal Cottage and came towards her. She didn't speak about the phone call to Emma, but reported her conversation with Harkness. Benton said, "I'm surprised he didn't say that if the body count continues to go up, we'll soon solve the case by the process of elimination. What photographs do you want taken, ma'am?" For the next quarter of an hour, they worked together. Benton photographed the body with the cope in place, and then the battered face, the chapel, the area around it, and the upper and lower cliff, focusing on a partly demolished dry stone wall. Then they moved to Chapel Cottage. How strange, thought Kate, that silence could be oppressive, that the dead Boyd was more vividly present to her in this emptiness than he had been in life. She said, "The bed's made up. He didn't sleep here last night. That means he died where we found him, in the chapel." They moved into the bathroom. The bath and basin were dry, the towels in place. Kate said, "There may be prints on the showerhead or taps, but that'll be for backup, if and when it's safe for them to come. Our job is to protect the evidence. That means locking and sealing the cottage. The best chance may be DNA on the towels, so they'd better go to the lab." And now, through the open door, they heard the rumble of the buggy. Looking out, Kate said, "Rupert Maycroft on his own. He'd hardly bring Dr. Staveley or Joe Staveley. They'll be in the sick room. I'm glad it's only Maycroft. It's a pity he has to see the cope, but at least the face will be covered." The stretcher had been placed crossways in the back of the buggy. Benton helped Maycroft unload it. Maycroft waited while he and Kate wheeled it into the chapel. A few minutes later, the sad procession began its way over the scrubland, Maycroft driving the buggy in front, Kate and Benton behind, pushing and walking, one on each side of the stretcher. To Kate, the whole scene was unreal, a bizarre and alien rite of passage. The fitful sunlight, less strong now, and a lively breeze lifting Maycroft's hair, the bright green of the cope like a gaudy shroud, herself and Benton, grave-faced mourners, walking behind the lumbering buggy, the body jolting from time to time as the wheels hit a hummock, the silence broken only by the sound of their progress, by the ever-present murmur of the sea, and the occasional, almost human shrieking of a flock of gulls which followed them, wings beating, as if this strange cortege offered a hope of scraps of bread. Book 4, Chapter 4. It was nearly 9:30. Kate and Benton had spent some 20 minutes with Maycroft, discussing the logistics of this new situation, and now it was time to face the rest of the company. At the door of the library, Benton saw Kate hesitate, and he heard her deep, steadying breath, and felt as if it were his own. He could see the tension in her shoulders and neck as she raised her head to face what lay beyond the smooth, excluding mahogany. Looking back later, he was to be astonished at how many thoughts and fears had been crowded into those 3 seconds of time. He felt a spasm of pity for her. This case would be vital for her, and she knew it. It could make or break him, too. But it was she who was in charge. And could she ever bear to work for Dalgliesh again if she failed both herself and him? He had a sudden vivid image of Dalgliesh's final words to her outside the chapel, her face, her voice. He thought, she's in love with him. She thinks he's going to die. But the pause could only have lasted for a few seconds. Before grasping the knob, she turned it firmly. He closed the door behind them. The smell of fear met them, sour as a sick-room miasma. How could the air be so tainted? He told himself that he was being fanciful. It was just that all the windows were closed. They were breathing stale air, infecting each other with fear. The scene which met him was different from that first time in the library. Had it really been only 3 days ago? Then they had been sitting at the long rectangular table, like obedient children, awaiting the arrival of the headmaster. Then he had sensed shock and horror, but also excitement. Most in that room had had nothing to fear. For those on the margins of murder, involved but innocent, it could hold a terrible fascination. Now he sensed only fear. As if unwilling to meet each other's eyes across the table, they had arranged themselves about the room. Only three were sitting together. Mrs. Plunkett was sitting next to Milly Tranter, their hands on the table, the cook's large hand enclosing the girl's. Jago was on Milly's left, and at the end of the table, a white-faced Mrs. Burbridge sat rigidly, the embodiment of horror and grief. Emily Holcomb had taken one of the high-backed leather chairs before the fireplace, and Rortwood stood behind her at attention, a guardian on duty. Mark Yellen sat opposite, his head leaning back, his arms held loosely on the rests, as relaxed as if preparing to doze. Miranda Oliver and Dennis Tremlett had placed two of the smaller library chairs together in front of one of the bookcases, and were seated side by side. Dan Paget, also on one of the smaller chairs, sat alone, his arms hanging between his knees, his head bowed. As they entered, all eyes turned to them, but at first no one moved. Maycroft, who had entered behind them, went over to the table and took one of the empty chairs. Kate said, "Can we please have a window open?" It was Jago who got up and moved from casement to casement. A chill breeze flowed in, and they heard more clearly the pounding of the sea. Miranda Oliver said, "Not all the windows, Jago. Two are enough." There was a tinge of petulance in her voice. She looked round at the others as if seeking support, but no one spoke. Jago quietly closed all but two windows. Kate waited. Then she said, "There are two reasons why we're all here together now, all except Dr. Staveley and his wife, and they will be joining us shortly. Mr. Maycroft has told you that there has been a second death on the island. Commander Dalgliesh found the body of Adrian Boyd in the chapel at 8 o'clock this morning. You will already know that Dr. Speidel is being cared for in hospital, and that he has SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome. Unfortunately, Mr. Dalgliesh has also been taken ill. This means that I am now in charge, with Sergeant Benton Smith. It also means that all of us here will be quarantined. Dr. Staveley will explain how long that is likely to last. During that time, my colleague and I will, of course, investigate both Mr. Oliver's death and the murder of Adrian Boyd. In the meantime, we think it would be wise, as well as a convenience, if those of you in the cottages move to the stable block or to the house. Would you like now to say something, Mr. Maycroft?" Maycroft got to his feet. Before he could begin speaking, Mark Yellen said, "You use the word murder. Do we understand that this second death can't be either accident or suicide?" Kate said, "Mr. Boyd was murdered. I'm not at this moment prepared to say more than that. Mr. Maycroft?" No one spoke. Benton had braced himself for a vocal reaction, disjointed muttering, exclamations of horror or surprise, but they seemed in shock. All he heard was a concerted intake of breath, so low that it seemed no more than the susurration of the freshening breeze. All eyes turned to Maycroft, He got up and grasped the back of his chair, nudging Jago away, seeming unaware of his presence. His knuckles were white against the wood, and his face, drained not only of colour but of all vitality, was the face of an old man. But when he spoke, his voice was strong. "Inspector Miskin has given you the facts. Guy and Joe Staveley are at present looking after Mr. Dalgliesh, but Dr. Staveley will be here shortly to talk to you about SARS. All I want to say is to express to the police, on behalf of us all, our shock and horror at the death of a good man, who was part of our community, and to say that we shall cooperate with Inspector Miskin's inquiry, as we did with Mr. Dalgliesh's. In the meantime, I have discussed with her what domestic arrangements we are to make. With this new, seemingly motiveless murder, all the innocent are in some danger. We may have been too ready to assume that our island is impregnable. We have been wrong. I have to emphasize that that is my opinion, not that of the police, but they are anxious for us all to be together. There are two vacant guest suites here in the house, and some accommodation in the stables. You all have keys, and I suggest you lock your cottages and bring what you need here with you. The police may need access to the cottages to search for any intruder, and I am providing Inspector Miskin with a set of keys. Has anyone any questions?" Emily Holcomb's voice was firm and confident. Of all the people in the room, it seemed to Benton that she was the least changed. She said, "Rotwood and I would prefer to stay in Atlantic Cottage. If I need protection, he is perfectly able to provide it. We have locks to protect us from any night marauders. Since we can hardly imprison ourselves here in the house without inconvenience, those of us who feel adequately protected may as well stay where we are." Miranda Oliver broke in almost before she had finished. The eyes of the group, as if they were automata, turned to her. "I want to stay where I am. Dennis has moved into my cottage, so I'll be safe. I think it's common knowledge now that we're going to be married. It wouldn't be appropriate to announce it in the papers so soon after my father's death. But we are engaged. Naturally, I don't want to be parted from my fiancé at a time like this." Benton thought that the statement had been rehearsed in advance, but it still astounded him. Didn't she realize how inappropriate was the triumphant announcement of an engagement at such a moment? He sensed a general embarrassment. How odd that a social gaffe could actually disconcert people when they were faced with murder and the fear of death. Emily Holcomb said, "What about you, Dr. Yelland? Your cottage is the most remote."
"Oh, I shall move in here. There's only one person on this island who can feel safe from being murdered, and that's the murderer himself. Since I'm not he, I would prefer to be here in the house rather than alone in Merlet Cottage. It seems to me likely that the police are dealing with a psychologically disturbed killer who may not be rational in choosing another victim. I'd prefer one of the guest suites in the house rather than the stable block, and as I've brought work with me, I shall need a desk." Maycroft said, "Jago will need to stay in his cottage to keep surveillance on the harbour. Are you happy with that, Jago?"
"Someone's got to be in that cottage, sir, and I wouldn't fancy it being anybody but me. I can look after myself."
Since Maycroft had finished speaking, Millie had been unobtrusively sobbing, the sound as low and pathetic as a kitten's mewing. Mrs. Plunkett from time to time tightened her grip on the small fist, but made no other comforting move. No one else took any notice, but now Millie cried out,
"I don't want to move in here. I want to get off this island. I'm not staying where people get murdered. You can't make me stay."
She turned to Jago.
"Jago, you'll take me, won't you? You'll take me in the launch. I can stay with Jake. I can go anywhere. You can't keep me here."
Yellen said,
"I suppose she's technically right. We stay in quarantine voluntarily, surely. The appropriate authority, whichever one is responsible for the island, can't invoke compulsory measures unless we're actually suffering from an infectious disease. I'm perfectly prepared to stay. I'm just asking about the legal position."
Now Maycroft's voice was more commanding than Benton had heard before.
"I'm ascertaining the position.
If anyone did leave, I imagine they would be advised to stay at home and keep away from other people until the incubation period is past. I believe that to be 10 days, but we shall know more from Dr. Staveley. But the question is academic. No visitors' boats come to Coombe, and certainly none will be allowed to land now. Emily said,
So in fact we're prisoners.
Hardly more, Emily, than we are when there's thick fog or violent storms. The launch is under my control. I don't intend to make it available until the incubation period is over. Does anyone quarrel with that?
No one did, but Millie's voice rose into a crescendo.
I don't want to stay. You can't make me.
Jago shifted his chair closer to her and whispered in her ear. No one heard what he said, but Millie gradually grew quiet. Then she said querulously,
Then why can't I be in Harbour Cottage with you?
Because you're going to be in the big house with Mrs. Burbridge. No one's going to harm you. Be brave and sensible, and you'll be a right heroine when this is over.
During this time, Mrs. Burbridge hadn't spoken. Now she said, her voice breaking,
Not one of you has said anything about Adrian Boyd. Not one. He's been brutally killed, and all we're thinking about is our own safety. Whether we'll be the next one. Whether we'll get SARS. And he's in some morgue, waiting to be cut up and labelled, an exhibit in a murder case.
Maycroft said patiently, Evelyn, I said he was a good man, and he was. And you're quite right. I've been too preoccupied with the problem of coping with a double emergency to find the right words. But we shall find a time to grieve for him.
You didn't find a moment to grieve for my father?
Miranda was on her feet.
You didn't care whether he was dead or alive. Some of you were glad he was dead. I know what you thought about him, so don't think I'm going to stand up for 2 minutes' silence for Mr. Boyd, if that's what you have in mind.
She turned to Kate.
And don't forget, Daddy died first. You're supposed to be investigating that, too.
We are investigating it. Benton thought. We need to keep them together. We can't protect them all, and at the same time investigate a double murder. This is the only chance we'll have to exert our authority. If we don't take control now, we never shall. We can't let Emily Holcomb take over.
He glanced at Kate, and somehow she grasped the force of his anxiety. She said,
Have you anything to add, Sergeant?
Only this, ma'am. He turned to the group, then fixed his eyes on Emily Holcomb. We're not asking you to move from the cottages merely because you'll be safer. With Mr. Dalgleish ill, we need to use effectively what manpower we have. It's sensible as well as prudent for all of you to be in one place. Those who don't cooperate will be seriously hampering the investigation.
Was there, Benton wondered, a glimpse of grim amusement on Miss Holcomb's face?
She said, If you put it like that, Sergeant, I suppose we have no choice. I've no wish to be used as a scapegoat for failure. I would like my parents' bedroom in the house. Rotwood will be in the stable block. And you'd better join me in the house, Miranda. Mr. Tremlett was perfectly comfortable before in the stable block. You should be able to tolerate a night or two apart.
Before Miranda could reply, the door opened and Guy Staveley came in. Somehow Benton had been expecting him to be wearing a white coat, and now the brown corduroy trousers and tweed jacket in which he had started the day seemed incongruous. He came into the room quietly. His face was as grave as Maycroft's, and before speaking he looked across at his colleague, as if seeking reassurance. But his voice was steady and surprisingly authoritative. This was a different man from the Staveley Benton had first seen. All eyes were on him. Glancing from face to face, Benton saw hope, anxiety, and the mute appeal he had seen in other eyes, the desperate need for the reassurance of an expert. The chair at one end of the rectangular table was vacant, and Staveley took it, facing Mrs. Burbridge. Maycroft moved to his right, and those of the company still standing, including Kate, found themselves seats. Only Benton remained standing. He moved over to the window, relishing the inrush of the sea-smelling breeze. Staveley said,
"Inspector Miskin will have told you that we now know that Dr. Speidel is suffering from SARS. He is in a special isolation unit in Plymouth and is being well cared for. His wife and some of his family are arriving from Germany and will, of course, only see him under controlled conditions. He's still seriously ill. I have also to tell you that Commander Dalgleish has caught the infection and is at present in the sick room here. Samples will be taken to confirm the diagnosis, but I'm afraid there can be little doubt. If his condition worsens, he too will be transferred by helicopter to Plymouth. First of all, I want to reassure you that the primary way that SARS spreads is by close person-to-person contact, perhaps by droplets when the infected person coughs or sneezes, or by someone touching the surface or object which has been contaminated by infected droplets and then carrying them to the nose, mouth, or eyes. It's possible that SARS might be carried through the air by other means, but at present no one seems sure of that. We can take it that only those of you who came into close contact with either Dr. Speidel or Mr. Dalgleish are seriously at risk. Nevertheless, it is right that everyone here on Coombe should be in quarantine for about 10 days. The Public Health Authority has powers to enforce quarantine on an infected person, and in some cases on those at risk from infection. I don't know whether they would do so for those of you who have not been in close contact with Dr. Speidel and Mr. Dalgleish, but I hope we can agree that the most sensible thing is for all of us to accept voluntary quarantine and to stay here on the island until we're advised that it's safe to leave. After all, we're not being quarantined away from home. Except for the police and our visitors, Coombe is our home. We're only being asked to forego our trips to the mainland until the danger of infection is over. If anyone objects to this, will you please let me know?" No one spoke. Millie looked for a second rebellious, then subsided into glum resignation. Then Paget spoke, his voice high.
"It isn't convenient for me. Coombe isn't my home, not now. I've got an interview in London for a university course. I'm leaving Coombe now that Mother's dead, and it's impossible for me to stay on for 10 days. If I miss the interview, I may lose my chance of a place."
It was Yelland who surprisingly replied,
"That's ridiculous. Of course they'll keep a place. They'd hardly welcome your appearance if they'd thought you'd been exposed to infection from SARS."
"I haven't been. Dr. Staveley's just explained."
"Commander Dalgleish interviewed you, didn't he? Either he or one of his colleagues. And they've been exposed to infection. Why not accept the inevitable and stop whining?"
Paget flushed and seemed about to speak. Then Dr. Staveley said,
"So, we agree to accept voluntary quarantine. I'll let the authorities know. Of course, while this is happening, there'll be a great deal of international activity. Tracing visitors who flew from Beijing with Dr. Speidel, and the friend he stayed with in the south of France. That's not my responsibility, thank God. My wife and I are caring for Commander Dalgleish at present, but I may have to transfer him to Plymouth later. In the meantime, if any of you fall ill, please come at once to the surgery. SARS usually begins with a fever and the symptoms associated with flu, headache, general feeling of being unwell, aches in the body. Some patients, but not all, have a cough at the very outset. I think that's all I have to tell you at present. The murder of Adrian Boyd, which normally would drive all other worries and considerations from our minds, is in the hands of Inspector Miskin and Sergeant Benton Smith. I hope we shall all cooperate with them, as we did with Commander Dalgleish. Has anyone any questions?" He turned to Maycroft. "Have you anything further to say, Rupert?"
"Only about publicity. This news will break on the 1 o'clock news bulletins, on radio and on television. I'm afraid it will be the end of privacy on the island. We're doing all we can to cut the nuisance to a minimum. All the phones here are ex-directory, which doesn't mean some people won't discover the numbers. The public relations branch of New Scotland Yard are dealing with publicity about the murders. The line is that investigations are proceeding, but it's very early days. The inquest on Mr. Oliver has been postponed, and when it takes place is likely to be adjourned. Those of you who are interested in the publicity
and want to share in the drama might be able to persuade Mrs. Plunkett to let you watch her television. The newspapers, together with the necessary supplies, will be dropped by helicopter tomorrow. I can't say I'm looking forward to their arrival. Dr. Yellen said, "What about your temporary staff on the mainland, the ones who come over by the week? Won't they be harassed by journalists?" "I don't think their names are generally known. If the press do get in touch, I doubt whether they'll get much help. There's no reasonable possibility of anyone landing on the island. The helicopter pad will be made unusable, except when we know an air ambulance is arriving or supplies are being delivered. There'll probably be some noise nuisance from other helicopters circling, but we'll have to put up with that. Have you anything more you want to say, Inspector?"
"Just one or two things to add to what I said earlier. People should stay together as much as they can. If you want exercise, take one or two companions and stay within sight of the house. You all have keys to your cottages or to your rooms in the house or the stable block, and will probably prefer to keep them locked. Sergeant Benton Smith and I would like your consent to search any of your rooms if it proves necessary. I'm anxious to save time. Has anyone any objection?"
No one spoke.
"Then I'll take that as consent. Thank you. Before we disperse, I'd like you all to write down where you were and what you were doing between 9 o'clock last night and 8 o'clock this morning. Sergeant Benton Smith will bring in the necessary paper and pens and collect your scripts." Emily Holcomb said, "We'll look like a bunch of over-mature university students tackling their final exam papers. Will Sergeant Benton Smith be invigilating?"
Kate said, "No one will, Miss Holcomb. Are you proposing to cheat?" She turned to the rest of the company.
"That will be all for now. Thank you."
The sheets of paper and pens had been placed ready on Maycroft's desk. Crossing the corridor to collect them, Benton reflected that Kate and his first encounter with the suspects as a duo hadn't gone badly. He sensed that they were now reverting to the comforting theory that somehow a stranger had managed to get on the island. If so, there was no point in disabusing them. The fear of a psychopathic murderer at large would at least keep them together. And there was another advantage. The murderer, feeling himself safer, would become more confident. It was when a murderer grew in confidence that he was most at risk. He glanced at his watch. It would be high tide in less than 40 minutes. But first they must see Mrs. Burbridge. Her evidence could make that dangerous climb unnecessary. Unlike the others, she hadn't settled down to write her statement, but had folded the sheet of paper and placed it carefully in her bag. Now, getting to her feet, as if she had suddenly become an old woman, she was making for the door. Opening it for her, Kate said, "We'd like to have a word with you, Mrs. Burbridge, and it is rather urgent. Shall we do that now?" Without looking at them, Mrs. Burbridge said, "If you'll give me just 5 minutes, please, just 5 minutes." She was gone. Benton glanced at his watch. "Let's hope it isn't more, ma'am." Book 4, Chapter 5. Mrs. Burbridge received Kate and Benton at her door without speaking, and somewhat to Kate's surprise, led them not into the sitting room, but into the sewing room. There she seated herself at the larger table. In the library, Kate had been too preoccupied with finding the right words to concentrate on individual faces. Now she was looking at a woman so altered by grief that she was unrecognizable as the woman she had first seen after Oliver's murder. Her skin was a grey-green parchment, creased with furrows, and the pain-filled eyes, swimming in a moist bed of unshed tears, had lost all colour. But Kate saw something more, a desolation of spirit which was beyond comfort. She had never felt more inadequate or more helpless. She wished passionately that A.D. were here. He would know what to say. He always did. Fleetingly, images of former bereavements passed through her mind in a moving collage of grief. There had been so many of them, so much bad news to break, since she had first become a WPC. A succession of doors that opened even before her ring or knock. Wives, husbands,
children, seeing the truth in her eyes before she'd had time to speak, frantically rummaging in unfamiliar kitchens to make the traditional nice cup of tea, which was never nice, and which the bereaved drank with heart-rending courtesy. But this distress was beyond the transitory comfort of hot sweet tea. Glancing round the sewing room as if seeing it for the first time, she was possessed by a confusing mixture of pity and anger. The bales of richly coloured silk, the cork board, patterned with cuttings, photographs, symbols, and in front of Mrs. Burbridge, the small folded cloth, enclosing the silk-embroidered strip on which Millie had worked. All evidence of innocent and happy creativity, which would now be forever tainted with horror and blood. They could only have waited in silence for 10 seconds, but time seemed to have stopped. Then the sad eyes looked into Kate's.
"It's the cope, isn't it? It's something to do with the cope. And I gave it to him."
Kate said gently, "It was placed over Mr. Boyd's body, but it wasn't used to kill him." Was that what Mrs. Burbridge had been thinking? Kate added, "He wasn't suffocated. The cope was just laid over him.
And is it stained with his blood?"
"Yes, I'm afraid it is." Kate opened her mouth to say the words, "But I think it can be cleaned," then stopped herself. She had heard Benton's quick intake of breath. Did he too realise that she had saved herself from a folly as insulting as it was stupid? Mrs. Burbridge wasn't grieving for the loss of an object she had lovingly created, nor for the waste of time and effort. And now she too looked round the room, as if it had become unfamiliar to her. She said,
"It's all pointless, isn't it? Nothing about it is real. It's just prettifying a fantasy. I gave him the cope. If I hadn't given it to him..."
Her voice broke. Kate said, "It would have made no difference. Believe me, the murderer would have struck whether or not the cope was there. It had nothing to do with the cope." Then Kate heard Benton speaking, and was surprised that his voice was so gentle. "It was the killer who put the cope over him. But it was appropriate, wasn't it? Adrian was a priest. Perhaps the silk of the cope was the last thing he felt. Wouldn't that have been a comfort to him?" She looked up at his face, then reached out a trembling hand and took his dark young hand in hers.
"Yes," she said. "It would. Thank you."
Kate quietly moved a chair next to her and sat close. She said, "We're going to catch this man, but we need your help. Particularly now Mr. Dalgleish is ill. We need to know what happened last night. You said you gave Mr. Boyd the cope." Mrs. Burbridge was calmer now. She said,
"He came to see me after dinner. I had my meal here, as I usually do, but I knew he was coming. We'd arranged it earlier. I told him that the cope was finished and he wanted to see it. If things had been different, if it hadn't been for Mr. Oliver's murder, Adrian was going to take it to the bishop. He'd suggested it, because for him it would have been a kind of test. I think he felt ready to leave the island, at least for a few days."
Kate asked, "So that was why the cope was packed in a box?"
"It was put in the box, but not to be taken off the island. We knew that couldn't happen, not yet. It was just that I thought Adrian would like to wear it, perhaps when he was saying evensong. He did most evenings. He wouldn't wear it to celebrate Mass. That wouldn't have been suitable. I could see when he was admiring it that he would like to put it on, so I said it would be helpful to know how it sat, if it was comfortable. That was just an excuse, really. I wanted him to have the pleasure of wearing it."
Kate said, "Do you remember at what time he left here, carrying it?"
"He didn't stay long. I could sense that he wanted to get back to his cottage. After he left, I put out the light here and went to listen to the radio in my sitting room. I remember looking at my watch because I didn't want to miss a program. It was 8:55.
Benton said, "You sensed that he wanted to get back to his cottage. Is that usual? I mean, did he seem in more of a hurry than normal? Were you surprised that he didn't stay longer? Did he give you the impression that he might be calling on anyone on the way home? The question was important, the answer crucial, and Mrs. Burbridge seemed to realize this. After a pause, she said, "It didn't seem unusual at the time. I thought that he had some work to do or a radio program he wanted to listen to. It's true he usually didn't hurry away, but it wasn't exactly hurrying, was it? He was here for 25 minutes. Benton asked, "What did you talk about?" "The cope, the stole, and other pieces I'd been working on. And he admired the altar fronts. It was just chat. We didn't mention Mr. Oliver's murder, but I think he was preoccupied. He was deeply affected by Mr. Oliver's death. Of course, we all were, but with him, it went deeper. But it would, wouldn't it? He understood about evil." Kate got up. She said, "I don't want you to be alone in this flat, Mrs. Burbridge. I know that everyone will be accommodated in the house, but even so, I'd prefer you not to be alone in your flat at night."
"Oh, but I won't be. Mrs. Plunkett doesn't want to be alone either, and she suggested I move in with her. Jago and Dan are going to move my bed for me. She would come here, I know, but she does like her television. I'm afraid neither of us will get much peace. People who aren't normally interested in television will want to watch the news now. Everything has changed, hasn't it?"
"Yes," said Kate. "I'm afraid it has."
"You asked me to write down what we were doing last night. I brought the paper away with me, but I haven't done anything with it. I couldn't bring myself to write down what happened. Does it matter?"
Kate said gently, "Not now, Mrs. Burbridge. You've told us what we needed to know. I'm afraid you may have to make a formal statement later, but don't worry about that for now." They thanked her and left, and heard the door being locked behind them. Benton said, "So he took an hour to get home. That walk across the scrubland, even in the dark, couldn't have taken more than half an hour, probably less. You'd better time it, preferably after dark. We can be reasonably certain Boyd didn't go for a stroll, not on a starless night and carrying a bulky package. He called on someone, and when we know who, we'll have Calcraft." She looked at her watch. "It's taken 20 minutes to get that information, but we couldn't hurry her, and it's important. I want to be on hand when Dr. Glenister arrives. We'll have to keep well clear of her, but I think we should be there when they take the body away." They were entering Kate's apartment when the telephone rang. Dr. Glenister was giving evidence of the Old Bailey and would be tied up for the next 2 days. There was a perfectly competent local man, and she suggested that they use him. Any exhibits could be taken to the lab when the body was removed. Replacing the receiver, Kate said, "Perhaps it's just as well. We've got work to do at the scene ourselves, and I want that stone if we can get it. If the tide's coming in, we may have wasted too much time already." Benton said, "Not wasted, ma'am. We had to see everyone on the island and ensure their safety. And we needed Mrs. Burbridge's evidence. If Boyd had given her any clue about where he was going, the case could have been solved. There's a limit to what we can do with only the two of us. And we should be all right with the tide if it turned just before 10 last night. That should give us roughly an hour before it's high again. Well, let's hope you're right." After a moment's hesitation, she said,
"You did well in there, Sergeant. You knew what to say to Mrs. Burbridge, what would comfort her."
"I've had a religious education, ma'am. It comes in useful sometimes." She looked at his dark, handsome face. It was as impassive as a mask. She said, "And now to ring Jago and ask him to meet us with the buggy and the climbing equipment. We can't tackle that cliff without him. Someone, I suppose Maycroft, will have to relieve him at Harbour Cottage." Book 4, Chapter 6. To Benton it had seemed an unconscionable time before Maycroft managed to free himself from his other preoccupations and went down to the harbour to take over from Jago and explain to him that he was wanted. Sensing that Maycroft would prefer to do this alone, they waited outside the lighthouse with the buggy. Benton resisting the temptation to keep gazing at his watch, an irritating obsession which only served to lengthen time. On impulse, he said, "I suppose it's safe to use him."
"As long as we don't let him see what, if anything, we manage to find."
"I was thinking of the climb, ma'am."
"We've no choice. AD said that he doesn't see Jago as our man, and he hasn't yet been wrong."
And now Jago was with them. He and Benton loaded the buggy with the climbing equipment, and Kate took the wheel. They bumped over the headland without speaking. Benton knew that she would want to preserve the ground around the scene of crime, and when they were some 20 yards from the chapel, she stopped the buggy. She said to Jago, "What we're looking for was probably thrown over the top or the lower cliff somewhere near the chapel. Either Sergeant Benton Smith or I must abseil down to make a search. We'll need your help."
Still, Jago didn't speak.
Kate slithered down between bushes and jutting rocks to the lower cliff, then, with the others following, walked along the narrow plateau until, looking up, she assessed they were under the chapel. They moved to the edge and looked down. The layered granite, in parts fissured, in others smooth as polished silver, fell some 80 feet to the sea. Broken only by jutting spurs like hanging baskets, the crevices festooned with foliage and clusters of small white flowers. At the foot of the cliff was a cove with no beach, heaped up to the rock face with stones and boulders. The tide was coming in fast. Kate turned to Jago.
"Is it possible to get down? Do you see any problems?"
At last Jago spoke.
"Not getting down, I don't. How do you intend to get back up? You need an experienced climber."
Kate asked, "Is there no other way of getting into the cove?" Jago said,
"Walk further along and look for yourself, Inspector. It's always cut off, no matter what the tide."
"And no chance of swimming round the headland?"
Jago's face was eloquent. He shrugged.
"Not unless you want to be cut to pieces. The underwater rocks are like razors."
Benton said, "My grandfather was a climber, and he taught me. If you're willing to come down with me, we should be able to get up. That is, if there's a classified climb."
"There's one about 30 yards south of the chapel. It's the only way up, but it's not for a novice. What's the hardest climb you've done?"
"Tatra, on the Dorset coast. It's near St. Anselm's Head." Benton thought, "And don't for God's sake ask me when that was." And now for the first time, Jago looked him in the face.
"Are you Hugh Benton Smith's grandson?"
"Yes." There was silence for a few seconds. Then Jago said,
"Okay, let's get on with it. You'd better give me a hand with the gear. We haven't much time."
They left Kate on the edge of the cliff. Within minutes, they were back. Jago led the way confidently, the rope slung over his shoulder. Following him with the rest of the equipment, Benton thought, "He knows every inch of this cliff. He's done this climb before." Dropping the ropes, Jago said,
"You'd better take your jacket off. The shoes look all right. Try one of these helmets for fit. The one with the red badge is mine."
The boulders here were larger, and the undercliff narrower than on any other part they'd seen. Jago put on his helmet, then quickly selected the rock he wanted, and, with the other two watching, took 3 wide tapes, threaded them together and secured them round the boulder with a carabiner. Watching him screwing the heavy metal clip shut, Benton reflected that he hadn't thought of the word carabiner for over a decade, and the tapes were called slings. He must remember the names. Jago uncoiled the rope, threaded the middle through the carabiner, and, stretching his arms in wide sweeps, recoiled both halves of the rope and hurled them over the cliff. They fell, rhythmically uncoiling, patterned in blue and red on the shining air. For Benton, time stopped, and for one disorientating second spun out of control, then latched onto memory. He was 14 again, and standing with his grandfather on top of that cliff on the Dorset coast. His grandfather, whom he had always called Hugh, was a twice-decorated fighter pilot in the Second World War, and after those tumultuous years had never adjusted to an earthbound world, in which the death of the best of his friends had left him a reluctant, half-guilty survivor. Even in adolescence, Benton, loving him and desperately anxious to please, had sensed something of the loss and shame which lay behind his grandfather's brittle, half-mocking carapace. Hugh had been an obsessive amateur climber, seeing in that no-man's land between air and rock something his grandson recognised as more than a sport. Francis, he was never called Benton by Hugh, had longed to share his passion, knowing even then that what his grandfather was teaching him was how to master fear. In his first year at university, when Hugh had fallen to his death climbing in Nepal, his enthusiasm for the rock face dwindled. None of his friends climbed. His life was full of other more insistent interests. Now, in that second of memory, he heard Hugh's voice. "The climb's a V.S., very severe, but I think you're ready for it, Francis. Are you?"
"Yes, Hugh, I'm ready."
But it was Jago's voice he was hearing. "The climb's a V.S., but as you've done Tatra, you should be ready for it, okay?" And this, he knew, was his last chance to withdraw. Soon he could be standing on that narrow fringe of stony, sea-thrashed shore, facing a dangerous climb, perhaps with a murderer. Mentally he spoke Kate's words. "A.D. doesn't see Jago as our man, and he's never yet been wrong." He looked at Jago and said, "I'm ready." He took off his jacket and felt through the fine woolen jersey the chill of the wind, like a cold poultice on his back. Buckling on the harness with its waistband of carabiners, slings and nuts, he tried the two helmets, found one that fitted, and strapped it on. He glanced at Kate. Her face was rigid with anxiety, but she didn't speak. He wondered if she wanted to say, "You don't have to do this, I'm not ordering you," but knew that to put the onus on him would be an abdication of her responsibility. She could stop him, but she couldn't order him to climb. He wondered why he was so glad of that. Now she took a plastic exhibit bag and a pair of search gloves from her case and handed them to him. Without speaking, he shoved them in his trouser pocket. He watched while Jago satisfied himself that the slings round the boulder were secure, then clipped the rope through the carabiner at his waist. It came back to him so easily now, the rope over the right shoulder and round his back. No one spoke. He remembered that this routine preparation for a climb had always been done in silence. A formal, purposeful, putting on of courage and resolution. Almost, he thought, as if his grandfather had been an ordained priest, and he the acolyte, both performing some wordless but long familiar sacerdotal rite. Jago was an unlikely priest. Trying to relieve fear with sardonic humour, Benton told himself that he, Benton, was more likely to end as the sacrificial victim. He walked to the very edge of the cliff, braced his feet, and leaned backwards into space. This was the moment of commitment, and it brought with it the remembered mixture of terror and exhilaration. If the belay didn't hold, he would plunge some 80 feet to his death. But the rope tightened and held. For a second, almost horizontal, he raised his eyes to the sky. The scudding clouds were racing in a vortex of white and pale blue, and beneath him the sea thudded against the rock face in relentless waves of sound that he seemed to be hearing for the first time. But now all was easy, and he felt, after more than a decade, some of that boyhood exhilaration in bouncing and sliding down the rock face, the left hand controlling the rope from behind, the right on the rope in front, feeling it slide through the carabiner, knowing that he was in control. His feet struck ground. Quickly he released himself and shouted that he was down. Smoothing on his search gloves, he surveyed the narrow strip of sea-smoothed rocks and pebbles, assessing where best to begin. The tide was coming in strongly, splurging over the smooth humps of the farthest outcrop, swirling into the deep rock pools, advancing and then briefly retreating to glitter the treacherous surfaces of rounded stones and the shards of broken granite. Time was against him. With every wave, the field of search narrowed. Eyes down, he crouched forward, yard by careful yard. He knew what he was looking for. A heavy stone, but small enough to be held in the hand. A tool of death on which, with luck, there would still be some trace of blood. His heart grew more leaden with every yard. Even on this narrow fringe of shore, the stones were piled in thousands, many of the right size and weight, and most washed smooth by centuries of the sea. He was wasting time on a fruitless search, and he still had that climb to face. Minutes passed, and his hopes were fading. The exhilaration of the abseil was forgotten. He pictured Kate waiting above for the call which would signal success. Now there would be only a single shout to let Jago know it was time for him to abseil down. And then he saw, close to the edge of the cliff, something that should surely not be there on this untrodden shore, a pale flutter of litter. Going up to it, he gazed down, and for a second was tempted to fling his arms wide and give a shout of triumph. What he saw was an egg-shaped stone, half enclosed in what was obviously the remnant of a surgical glove. Most of the thin latex must have been torn when it fell, rolled in the waves of the receding tide, and blown away. But one finger and a small part of a palm was still intact. Carefully he picked up the stone and examined the surface. The reddish stain, which didn't seem part of the natural stone, could surely only be blood. It must be blood. It had to be blood. He put his trophy into the exhibit bag, closed it, and ran stumbling towards the abseil rope. He tied the bag to the end of it, and putting both hands to his mouth, gave a triumphant bellow.
Got it! Heave it up!
Looking up, he could glimpse Kate's face gazing down. She gave a wave of the hand, and the rope, with its package, rose, bumping gently against the rock face. Almost immediately it was lowered again, and Jago was coming down as quickly as if in free fall, the stocky body seeming to dance against the cliff. He released himself, gave a tug on the rope. It fell in coils at his feet. He said,
"The climb's only 30 yards away, round this outcrop of rock. I'll fix the belay."
The layered and fractured cliff towered above them. The surf was already breaking over their feet.
Jago said, "You can lead. If you've done Tatra, it shouldn't be too difficult. It's steep and exposed, but well protected at the crucial moves. The crux is the roof at the top of that crack.
There's a peg just before it, right under the roof. Make sure you clip in. Don't worry, it's an overhang, so if you lob, at least you'll fall clear of the rock."
Benton hadn't expected to lead. He thought, Jago planned this from the beginning, but then he's controlled every aspect of this climb. He was too proud to argue about the order, but Jago would have depended on that too. He made a bowline at the end of the rope and attached it to his harness, while Jago made a careful belay on a large boulder at the foot of the climb, then took hold of the rope and said,
"Okay, if you're ready."
And now, as if to emphasize the inevitability of the climb, a large wave thundered in, almost sweeping them off balance. Benton began climbing. The first 15 feet were not too difficult, but he thought carefully about each hand and foot placement, feeling for the cracks in the rock, moving upward when he was confident he had a hold. After 15 feet, he took a nut from the rack at his waist and slid it into a crack, jiggling until it was firm. He attached a runner, clipped in the rope, then moved on with more confidence. The rock became steeper, but was still firm and dry. He found another crack, and threaded in another nut and runner. He was some 30 feet above the ground when, suddenly and to his horror, he froze, all confidence gone. He had stretched his arms too widely to find a hold, and found himself spread-eagled against the rock face, his shoulders so taut that they felt racked. He was terrified to try for another foothold in case he lost his precarious balance. His cheek was placed hard against the granite, which now felt wet and icy cold, and he realized that the rock face was damp with his sweat. There was no call from Jago, but he remembered his grandfather's voice calling down to him on the fourth climb they'd done together. "This is classified VS, so there'll be a hold. Take it slowly, Francis. It isn't a race." And now, after what seemed an eternity, but must have been no more than half a minute, the tension in his shoulders eased. Tentatively, he moved his right hand up and found a hold a few feet higher, then holds for his feet. The panic was over, and he knew it wouldn't return. 5 minutes later, his helmet bumped gently against the overhanging roof. This was the crux. It was a jutting shelf of splintered granite, festooned with foliage. A gull had perched on the edge, bright-beaked, motionless in its sleek white and grey perfection, dominating the cliff, and seeming oblivious to the sweating invader only 2 feet below. Then it rose in a tumult of battered air, and he felt, rather than saw, its white wings passing over his head. He knew that there would be a piton already in place at the top of the crack. If he failed to climb the roof, it would have to hold him. He found the peg, clipped on one end of a long runner, and then called down, "Tight rope!" and felt it tighten. Looking down and using the tension on the rope for balance, he reached round the roof with his right hand and felt for a hold on the wall above. After 30 seconds of anxious scrabbling, he found it, and then one for his left hand. Swinging into the air, he pulled up on his hands, found holds for his feet, and got back into balance. He put another runner over a flake of rock and clipped on. He was secure. And now there was no more anxiety, only a remembered joy. The rest of the climb was steep, but the rock was clean, with good holds all the way to the top. He hauled himself over the edge of the cliff and lay for a moment, exhausted, with the smell of earth and grass like a benison, and the sand gritty against his mouth. He got to his feet and saw Kate coming towards him. Looking into her face, radiant with relief, he had to resist a ridiculous impulse to rush into her arms. She said, "Congratulations, Benton," then turned away, as if afraid to let him see what the strain of the last half hour had done to her. He found the nearest large boulder, made a belay, clipped in, took hold of the rope, and called down to Jago, "Climb when you're ready." Kate, he knew, would have dealt with the evidence while Jago was at the bottom of the cliff. The stone and the remnant of torn latex would already have been sealed in an exhibit bag. And now Jago's life was in his hands. He felt an old exhilaration like a surge of the blood. This was what it was about. The shared danger, the mutual dependence, the fellowship of the climb. With astonishing speed, Jago was with them, hauling up and recoiling the ropes, carrying the gear. He said, "You did all right, Sergeant." He strode off with his gear towards the buggy, then hesitated and turned back. Walking up to Benton, he held out his hand. Benton grasped it. Neither spoke. They threw the climbing gear into the back of the buggy and climbed in. Kate took the wheel, turned the key in the ignition, and made a wide sweep to trundle back towards the house. Looking at her face, Benton realized, in a moment of surprised revelation, that Kate could be called beautiful. Book 4, Chapter 7. All through the rest of Tuesday, part of Kate's mind was in that unseen sick room on the top floor of the tower, and she had to restrain herself from phoning Guy or Joe Staveley to inquire what was happening. But she knew that if there were anything to tell her, they would find time to telephone. In the meantime, they had their job to do, and she had hers. Mrs. Burbridge, finding what relief she could in domestic routine from the double peril of a murderer at large and a potentially fatal disease, asked what they would like for supper, and whether it should be delivered to Seal Cottage. The thought was intolerable to Kate. To sit at the table where Dalgleish had sat, seeing his raincoat hanging in the porch, to feel his absence more strongly than his presence, would be like entering the house of the dead. Her apartment in the stable block was small, but it would do. She was anxious, too, to stay close to the house and have Benton next door. It wasn't only a matter of convenience. She admitted to herself that she would feel reassured by having him near. With that realization came another. He had become her colleague and partner. She told him what she had decided. Benton said, "If it's all right by you, ma'am, why don't I move my easy chair and anything else we need into your sitting room? Then we can use your apartment as the incident room and mine for meals." I'm quite good at cooking breakfast, and we've both got small fridges, large enough for milk anyway, which could be helpful if we're working late and need coffee. The rest of the rooms in the stable block haven't. Staff have to take what they need from the large fridge in the staff dining room. I've spoken to Mrs. Plunkett, and she can send over some salad and cold meats, or we can collect them. Would 1 o'clock be all right? Kate wasn't hungry, but she could see that Benton had his mind on food. And the lunch, when he fetched it, was excellent. The salad and cold lamb came with baked potatoes, followed by fruit salad. To her surprise, she ate it avidly. Afterwards, they sat down to discuss the future programme. Kate said, "We have to set priorities. We can begin by cutting down the number of suspects, at least for the present. Joe Staveley wouldn't have killed Boyd, and nor, I think, would her husband or Jago. We've always assumed that Mrs. Burbridge, Mrs. Plunkett and Millie are in the clear. That leaves us with Dennis Tremlett, Miranda Oliver, Emily Holcomb, Rortwood, Dan Paget and Mark Yelland. Logically, I suppose, we should include Rupert Maycroft, but we'll discount him for the present. We're assuming, of course, that there's only one murderer at Coombe, but perhaps we should keep an open mind." Benton said, "We've tended to discount Yelland, ma'am, or at least not to concentrate on him. But he hasn't an alibi, and he had as much reason to hate Oliver as anyone on the island. And I don't think we ought to eliminate Jago, at least not yet. And, of course, there's still Dr. Speidel. We've only his word for the time of the assignation." Kate said, "Let's begin by concentrating on Tremlett, Rortwood, Paget and Yelland. All four disliked Oliver, but we're up against the old problem as far as the first three are concerned. Why wait until this weekend to kill him? And you're right about Dr. Speidel. We need to question him again, if and when he recovers, but God knows how long that will be." Then they went through the written statements. As they had expected, no one admitted that they had been on the headland after 9 o'clock, except for the Staveleys, who had had dinner at the house with Rupert Maycroft and Adrian Boyd. Boyd had joined them in the library for his usual pre-dinner tomato juice. He had seemed subdued and preoccupied, but that didn't surprise them. He had been more upset than anyone over Oliver's death. Afterwards, he had only stayed for the main course, and had left, they thought, just before 8:30. The Staveleys and Maycroft had coffee together in the library. Then the Staveleys had left together by the front door of their cottage. They were a little vague about the time, but thought it was about 9:30. Kate said, "We'll see all of them individually tomorrow and see if there's anything else to be got out of them. We need to check the times." But there were other decisions that were more difficult. Ought they to ask all the suspects to hand over the clothing they had worn last night and send it to the lab when Boyd's body and the other exhibits were removed? As if sensing her dilemma, Benton said, "It seems pointless, ma'am, to start collecting clothes before we have a prime suspect. After all, unless we take the whole wardrobe, there's no guarantee they'll hand over what they were wearing. And Calcraft could have stripped to the waist. There was no hurry. He had the whole night to clean up after the job." Kate said, "There could be prints on the taps and the shower in Chapel Cottage, but all we can do there is to keep the place secure and preserve the evidence until the technical backup arrives, if ever. It almost makes me wish we were back in the old days, before our time, when the investigating officer would have an insufflator and equipment for fingerprinting in his murder kit and could get on with the job. But we'll bag up the bathroom towels in the hope of DNA, and we need to send the cardboard box with the body. I don't think we've got an exhibit bag big enough. We'll have to get a plastic bag from the house. We'll ask Mr. Maycroft, not Mrs. Burbridge." It was 3:30 before the helicopter arrived, and as soon as it landed, they unlocked Benton's apartment and wheeled out the stretcher. They had covered Boyd's body with a sheet, obscuring the cope, although they knew it was unlikely that Mrs. Burbridge would have kept silent. Kate wished that she had bound her to secrecy. That was a mistake, but one which it was probably too late to rectify. Millie would ask about the cope the next time she was in the sewing room, and it was hopeless to expect discretion from Millie. They had mittened Boyd's hands to preserve any possible evidence under the nails, but had done nothing else to the body. Distanced, they watched, standing side by side, as the masked figures zipped it into a body bag and lifted it and the exhibit bags aboard. Behind them, the house was absolutely silent, and they had no sense even of eyes watching from the windows. It was in curious contrast to the morning, when there had been constant activity as people moved into the house and the stable block. The buggy had lumbered to and fro, laden with the bags and books which Emily Holcomb considered necessary for her stay, and the luggage from Peregrine Cottage, with Tremlett driving and Miranda Oliver sitting bolt upright in the buggy, every inch of her rigid body expressing disapproval. Yelland carried his bags, striding in through the back door of the house and speaking to no one. Kate thought that it was as if the island were expecting an invasion, the barbarians already sighted, and everyone was seeking sanctuary in Coombe House, preparing to make a last stand. But then both the Staveleys came out of the house, and Jago appeared driving the buggy. Kate saw, with a lurch of the heart, that oxygen cylinders and two large boxes, obviously of medical equipment, were being carefully unloaded, and that Jago and Dr. Staveley were receiving them and placing them in the buggy. A table had been placed at some 20 yards from the helicopter, on which the formalities could be concluded without risk. With everyone masked and keeping their distance as far as possible, the business, including the handing over of the exhibit bags, took some time. 10 minutes later, the helicopter took off. Kate and Benton stood gazing up at it until it was out of sight, then turned silently away. The day wore on. There was little they could do now, as Kate had decided to leave the interviews until Wednesday. The day had been shocking for everyone. They had the written statements, and it would probably be unproductive to begin further questioning now. As daylight faded, she said, "I'm going up to the sick room. It's time we learnt what's happening to Mr. Dalgleish, and we need to know where the surgical gloves are kept, and who had access to them." She showered and changed before setting out, then went first to look at the sea, feeling the need for a few minutes of solitude. She both needed and feared an encounter with the truth. Dusk was falling fast, obliterating the familiar objects. Behind her, the lights came on one by one in Coombe House, but the cottages and all the stable block except her and Benton's rooms were in darkness. The lighthouse was the last to disappear, but even when its shaft had blurred into a pale spectre, the waves were still a white curdle against the blackening cliffs. She unlocked the side door and passed through the hall to the lift. Moving upwards, she stared at her image. Her face seemed years older, the eyes tired. With her fair hair tightly brushed back, her face looked vulnerable, stripped for action. Joe Staveley was in the surgery. It was the first time Kate had seen it, but she had no eyes for the details, except for the steel cabinets with their meticulously printed labels. She said, "How is Mr. Dalgleish?" Joe Staveley, white-coated, was standing at a desk, studying a file. She turned to Kate, a face from which all vitality had drained. Closing the file, she said, "I suppose the orthodox reply is that he's as well as can be expected, or I could say comfortable. Only he isn't comfortable, and his temperature is higher than we would like. It's early days. An erratic temperature may not be atypical. I've no experience in nursing patients with SARS. May I see him? It's important." "I don't think so. Guy is with him now. He'll be here in a minute. Why don't you sit down and wait until he comes?" "And Dr. Speidel?" "He'll live. Decent of you to ask. Most people seem to have forgotten him." Kate said, without preliminaries, "What happens if visitors need something from the surgery? Pills, a bandage, something like that?" The abrupt change of subject, the almost peremptory question, obviously surprised Jo. She said, "They'd ask me for it. There wouldn't be any problem. But is the surgery open? I mean, could they come and help themselves? Not to the drugs. All the prescription drugs are locked up. But the surgery door isn't locked." Even so, I can't see people wandering in and out. If they did, they couldn't do any harm to themselves or others. I keep some of the over-the-counter drugs like aspirin locked up too. She was looking at Kate now with frank curiosity. Kate persevered. And things like bandages or surgical gloves. I can't think why visitors should want them. But they're not locked up. If they did want them, I imagine they'd ask me or Guy. That would be courteous as well as sensible. They'd hardly help themselves. But you would know if any were missing. Not necessarily. There were things we needed when we were nursing Martha Paget. Mrs. Burbridge helped occasionally. She'd take what she needed. Why all this curiosity? You haven't found drugs, have you? If so, they didn't come from this surgery. No, I haven't found drugs. End of Disc 9.